And the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the chiefs of the people and hang them in the sun before the Lord, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." And Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you kill those of his men who have yoked themselves to Baal of Peor." And behold, one of the people of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman to his family in the sight of Moses, and in the sight of the whole congregation of the people of Israel, while they were weeping in the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose and left the congregation, took a spear in his hand, and went after the man of Israel into the chamber and pierced both of them, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. Thus the plague on the people of Israel was stopped. Nevertheless, those who died by the plague were 24,000. And the Lord said to Moses, "Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the people of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not consume the people of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and to his descendants after him the covenant of a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the people of Israel." Verse 14. The name of the slain man of Israel, who was killed with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, son of Salu, chief of a father's house belonging to the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, who was the tribal head of a father's house in Midian. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Harass the Midianites and strike them down, for they have harassed you with their wiles, which they beguiled you in the matter of Peor and in the matter of Cozbi, the daughter of the chief of Midian, their sister, who was killed on the day of the plague on account of Peor." This is the word of the Lord. You can be seated. Thank you. Okay, as the musicians make their way, I want to give my thanks to them. Each of those hymns were especially poignant and very appropriate for today's text. And I also want to extend my thanks for the opportunity to walk through God's Word with you all today. Thank you to Pastor Kyle for allowing me to step in and take part in the series through Numbers. There is a standard of fidelity and care for what the Lord has given us in His Word that is demonstrated regularly from this place, and I hope to maintain this today as we close out this section of the book. So I've titled this Failure at the Goal Line. In 2013, the Seattle Seahawks of the National Football League had done it. After 37 seasons of ups and downs, they had finally become Super Bowl champions. Margin of victory, 43-8, over the Denver Broncos, was the highest for a Super Bowl since 1989. Such a resounding victory seemed to signal more than just a one-off Super Bowl win. The team had a young core of players, which seemed to be the beginning of a new football dynasty. They had a young quarterback in Russell Wilson, who, in only his second NFL season, was quickly ascending to superstar status. They had a top running back who had more than earned his nickname Beast Mode. And as indicated by their allowing only 8 points in the Super Bowl, the Seahawks had a stifling defense, appropriately called Legion of Boom, a nod to their hard-hitting style and affinity to take on the role of the villain. Yes, it seemed as though this team had all the components in place for sustained success. And when the Super Bowl rolled around once again, there they were. The defending champions were back, seeking to claim a second victory in as many years. This time, the Seahawks faced a longtime menace in the New England Patriots. This matchup set up like a movie. The upstart Seahawks, with all the potential, versus the New England Patriots, the gold standard of sustained success behind their quarterback, Tom Brady, and head coach, Bill Belichick. This game was not nearly as one-sided as the year before. After a back-and-forth battle, however, the Seahawks held a 10-point lead going into the fourth quarter. But in that fourth quarter, the Patriots scored 2 touchdowns, taking a lead of 28-24, with only 2 minutes and 2 seconds remaining in the game. This proved to be plenty of time as the Seahawks worked their way down the field. It seemed as though they were well on their way to cementing themselves as one of the greatest teams in NFL history. Along the way, they were aided by a miraculous catch, where a Seahawks receiver jumped up, full extension, had the ball knocked away, and as he hit the ground, the ball fell, hit his legs, landed right in his arms for the completion. It was amazing. One play later, a handoff to Marshawn Beast Mode Lynch got the Seahawks to within 1 yard of the end zone with only 26 seconds remaining on the clock. A touchdown would seal a victory. However, though everything was pointing in the right direction, at the 1 yard line, everything changed. There, with a timeout still left if they needed to stop the clock, it seemed a foregone conclusion that the team would call for the ball to be handed off to the running back, who had already had just wild success in this game running the football. Instead, what unfolded was something that shocked everyone. The play was not a run, but a pass. The pass resulted in not a touchdown, but an interception at the goal line, a play widely remembered as one of the most shocking in Super Bowl history. But perhaps even more shocking is what happened following the end of the game. The team, with such great potential for sustained success, began to crumble. The aftermath of the defeat weighed heavily on the members of the team, and that core of talented players deteriorated. Though the Seahawks made it to the playoffs in 5 of 7 seasons since, the expected success in the postseason has eluded them. The lack of sustained success after such a bright start and high expectations led one sports writer to call them the dynasty that never was. Failure at the goal line and a disappointing result. And our text today presents a similar trajectory. The promising victories Israel had won, described in Numbers 21, in the confounding of Balak through Balaam's oracles in Numbers 22 through 24, leave us in a position of high expectations for the people of Israel. Surely this marks a turning point in the narrative. Israel's on the right track. God will bring them into the promised land. After all, they are in the plain of Shittim, just across the Jordan River from Jericho. Everything is primed and ready for them to cross over. But we find ourselves faced with great disappointment as Israel acts contrary to our expectations, though consistent with their character. Ultimately, this passage concludes the life of the first generation in the wilderness. And as we proceed through this chapter, we're going to follow a threefold pattern of narrative and discourse. So in first, verses 1 through 5, we will see an immoral Israel. Second, in verses 6 through 13, we will see a righteous representative. And then finally, third, in verses 14 through 18, we will see an external enemy. Numbers 25, 1 through 5. While Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the chiefs of the people and hang them in the sun before the Lord, that a fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." And Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you kill those of his men who have yoked themselves to Baal of Peor." From the beginning of chapter 22 to the end of chapter 24, we're dealing with a single episode between Balaam and Balak. The narrative moves slowly and methodically from Balak's recognition of the might of Israel to his attempt to have Israel cursed. And at the end of chapter 24, we are atop a mountain overlooking Israel with Balak, frustrated by Balaam's inability to pronounce a curse over the people of Israel. Rather than a curse, all this wicked prophet can do is bring forth blessing. The narrative in chapter 25, however, is anything but slow and methodical. And the opening lines cause us a bit of whiplash due to the change in content and pace of the narrative. The action is rapidly unfolding, and it gives a sense of chaos that is taking place in the camp. In other words, we move from the mountaintop with the Lord pouring out his blessing on Israel by the mouth of Balaam to the valley of Shittim, where we find out Israel is acting contrary to that very description, from the high of the mountain to the depths of the valley. This pairing of mountain and valley is, I think, very instructive. Of the mountaintop, Ian Duguid summarizes well, "In Balaam's oracle, they are a people dwelling alone and not counting itself among the nations. They see neither misfortune nor misery, for the Lord their God is with them. No sorcery or divination could succeed against Israel, for the Lord had blessed them, and he would not change his mind. These people are the upright, among whom it would be a privilege to die. Out of this chosen nation, the glorious Messianic King would rise to bring salvation for his people and judgment on all of God's enemies. But oh, how different the view from the valley. Far from dwelling alone and not counting itself among the nations, we read in the first line that the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. That is, they participated in prostitution with the daughters of Moab. While the mountaintop oracle proclaims they don't see any misfortune or misery because the Lord their God is with them, we now see that the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. No sorcery or divination could succeed against Israel? You mean this Israel, the ones who have now yoked themselves to Baal of Peor? Surely this cannot be the same group. But it is. It certainly is. And we should have known better than to get our hopes up on the mountaintop, for this is nowhere near the first time we've been here. The high of the mountaintop and the low of the valley should bring to mind another event in Israel's recent past. This is the narrative of Exodus 32, where we see the giving of the Ten Commandments. In both narratives, we have a prophet on a mountain receiving oracles from Yahweh. While this prophet is on the mountain, Israel is in the valley, pictured living 180 degrees opposite to what is expected of them. In Exodus, the people urged Aaron to craft an unauthorized representative for Yahweh. And in our present text, they have been seduced by a wicked plot to derail them into yoking themselves to a pagan deity. So, we should have been prepared for this. We should have known better. Fool me once and all that, right? But this time feels different. What do we make of this with the explicit blessing detailing such a high? What about the promise of the Messiah? Does this nullify all those promises? Does this event in the Valley of Shittim make a liar out of Yahweh? Well, it could certainly feel that way on the surface. But let me assure you that this pairing of mountaintop and valley does no such thing, and more on that in a moment. But now I want to briefly turn our attention to the nature of Israel's immorality. I think this is going to be critical for us to know how this passage remains relevant for us today. On the surface, it would be quite easy to make the application here, the horrible impact and effects of sexual immorality. And certainly the Bible has much to say about that subject. At this point, however, I feel compelled to make clear that the event is about much more than sexual immorality. This episode is primarily about false worship, of which sexual immorality plays a key role. And maybe you're like me and you wonder to yourself, what is wrong with these folks? I mean, how many times does the Lord have to make himself known to them for them to finally get it? It's a fair question, at least in my view, because it seems to happen so often and in such quick succession. The Lord is revealed, and the people fail to stay with him. For example, just think about Korah and the rebellion, right? People literally got eaten by the ground. Eaten by the ground. And then in 1641 it says, "But on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron." But on the next day, after seeing people getting eaten by the ground, on the next day, it baffles me. How is it that they cannot get it together? And while it's a fair question, I think it probably is one that's born out of our own perspective toward the text. As we sit here, we consider the existence of God in monotheistic terms, believing that there is a single deity. We view the question in terms of a strict either-or, right? God, either God exists or he doesn't. It's either Yahweh or it's not. It isn't a both and for us. And I think the residual issue for Israel here is that they did not have that perspective, at least not yet. Remember, the first generation is coming out of captivity in Egypt, where there were many deities. They were wandering among the people who held to regional deities that had a limited purview over the world. I think Israel's problem is not that they didn't believe Yahweh or believe in Yahweh necessarily. Rather, they treated him like they would just any other deity. Do you remember the report of the spies when they scoped out the land? Sure, the people were huge and many, but so was the food. The food was just huge. They had to have two people to carry a grape cluster out of there, and it was just growing everywhere. They were astounded by it. And remember, the source of a lot of their grumbling and complaining out here in the wilderness has to do with food. Lack of food, or at least food that they found desirable. And this is significant to our text because Baal was the Canaanite god of fertility, both of human fertility and for the land. You know, worship of Baal often included encounters with cult prostitutes in order to bring forth the blessings that he could bestow. And if the Canaanites believed that Baal was the god of fertility, and the Israelites saw the great yield of crops in the promised land, then wouldn't it be easy to see how they thought a good plan would be to say, hey, why don't we take advantage of this god over here, who's obviously bringing a blessing? In their minds, they weren't leaving Yahweh, no more than when they were at the foot of Sinai. The golden calf, after all, wasn't a representative or a replacement for Yahweh. It was not a substitute. It was intended to be representative. They started a party with the calf for Yahweh, the text tells us. Here, Baal isn't a substitute for Yahweh. Rather, it's an add-on. But the reality is that they should have known better. They have failed to realize that Yahweh is no regional deity. He is not one that is bound up to a particular location, helpful in only particular circumstances. They haven't understood what it means to be Yahweh's people. After all, the land has been prepared by Yahweh for them to enjoy. They should have remembered this. And friends, we too must be careful. We cannot permit our view of the Lord's providence and authority to be limited to a particular set of issues. And while we may not be tempted to yoke ourselves to another pagan deity in addition to Yahweh, I fear we can fall into the trap of adding to Yahweh in other ways. In fact, though we aren't confronted with following after pagan deities, we can find a similarity with Israel in the way that we can compartmentalize our world, right? Here's the work box, the home box, the family box, the recreation box. Over here, here's the church box. You know, God, he's really good for that one, right? But what about the rest? Do we daily recognize that he is Lord of all? Do we honor him as such? Do we live differently because of it? He is one. He is holy. He is singularly worthy of our worship. Friends, it may not be as dramatic a shift in our minds as forsaking him for another, but that is the reality when we allow ourselves to entertain worship of another. The equation is never Yahweh plus anything. It's him alone. The failure in the opening verses of Numbers 25 brings a severe judgment. The sinful participation in cultic worship of this pagan deity results in an example made of leaders who permitted such terrible actions and a plague on the people who engaged in such actions. They had yoked themselves to Baal, and they were receiving due punishment. But next, as we move on to our next section, we will see a righteous representative. Numbers 25, 6 through 13. And behold, one of the people of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman to his family in the sight of Moses and in the sight of the whole congregation of the people of Israel, while they were weeping in the entrances of at the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose and left the congregation and took a spear in his hand and went after the man of Israel into the chamber and pierced both of them, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. Thus the plague on the people of Israel was stopped. Nevertheless, those who died by the plague were 24,000. And the Lord said to Moses, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the people of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them. So I did not consume the people of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and to his descendants after him a covenant of a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the people of Israel. So we've just seen the pairing of a mountaintop scene with a valley, and now we observe another shift from the corporate to the individual. In verses 1 through 5, Israel is described almost as if it's a single entity. We can see this especially in the description of verse 3, where Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor. Furthermore, we are left to understand that the whole of the people have wandered off from Yahweh and given themselves over to this wickedness. That's because the picture in these preceding verses is of the corporate or the whole. We may here recall Paul in 1 Corinthians 12 when he says, "For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one spirit we were all baptized into one body." There's a certain oneness to God's people. And this is what we see here. But when we arrive in verse 6, we move from that corporate idea to an individual. While in the preceding section, the corporate view of Israel's sinfulness brought judgment on the leaders of the people, does not mean the individuals who took part in the acts are less responsible. And to bring this into full view is quite a dramatic scene. We're introduced to an anonymous couple, one Israelite man and a Midianite woman, who are involved in a bold act. Perhaps one that's more bold than we initially see. Because the reason Baal of Peor is called Baal of Peor is because the location where a temple is set up is on the Mount of Peor. This is where the worshipers and cult prostitutes would have worshipped. It's likely, therefore, that the immorality that we discussed in the first section is not taking place in the camp. It's likely up the mountain, which incidentally is the same mountain where the last two oracles of Balaam's prophecy are given. But now we see the Israelite man bringing a Midianite woman back into the camp, back to where his family is. And the brazenness of this act is amplified when we recognize that the whole congregation seemed to be mourning in repentance at the entrance of the tent of meeting, mourning the tragic loss of 24,000 relatives who had gone astray and left the Lord. They had forsaken their God and they had paid the price. Families lost their loved ones, first to their sin and then to death. So this couple walks back into the camp in the midst of a memorial service. One of Israel's sons walks back into the camp with the haughty, self-assured confidence of one callous to their own sinfulness. But there is another son. This is Phinehas, the son of the newly installed high priest Eleazar. He will tolerate no more of the brazen infidelity to Yahweh. He takes a spear and finishes the job, and the plague relents. This act of Phinehas is astounding, and the Bible's record of it is clear. The Lord speaks to Moses and makes two very significant statements. First, he continues the covenant of peace with Phinehas. This covenant is not a new one to be given, but it's a continuation of the one given to the Levites, who are charged with maintaining the covenant relationship between Yahweh and his people. Phinehas has just demonstrated that he is certainly up to the task. That Phinehas is the son of the high priest should not escape us. In the beginning of the book, we encounter two sons of the high priest, Aaron, who offered unauthorized fire and were put to death. Now we see a glimmer of hope for the priesthood in Israel as Phinehas undoes this with his righteous act. He sets forth a new hope. And the second thing that Yahweh says is that through his actions, Phinehas has made atonement for the people of Israel. Wow, what an amazing statement. Phinehas turns back the wrath from the people of Israel by making atonement for them. Phinehas is a righteous representative who has taken it upon himself to bring peace between Yahweh and his people, restoring the relationship through his obedience, and even taking on the mind of Yahweh, in that he is jealous with the jealousy of Yahweh. But I owe you something else at this point. Remember a few minutes ago when we were considering whether the actions in the valley render null and void the promises from the mountaintop, especially the promise of the glorious messianic king who would rise to bring salvation for his people and judgment on God's enemies, as Ian Dougald put so well. Well, here we are. Can you see it? Can you see how Phinehas is a representative, a representation of this Messiah who is to come? He is a righteous individual who mediates salvation to the people in his judgment on God's enemies. though we must recognize that Phinehas did not bring an ultimate end to these kinds of acts, Israel would still go on to fall into sinful patterns. But what this episode brings to light is that though the corporate view of Israel is that of a group who had yoked themselves to Baal of Peor, this is not the whole story. There is still a remnant of faithful and true followers of Yahweh, those who are a true representation of God's people on earth. But before we move on, there's one important implication that we need to consider for our present day. Just as there were two sons in this passage who both had a family claim to be called members of Israel, yet they had two different stories, so this is true for us today. There may be folks who have called themselves a part of the church but have no part in it. There may even be some folks in this room. You may think that you are to be counted among the people of God by virtue of tradition or family ties, but that is not the way it works. Participation in the true people of God has always been based on a right standing before Him. This may be an intimidating proposition. You may think that all of the things you've done or patterns in your life exclude you from participating in this people, and you'd be right. But the good news is that there is a way forward. There is a way to be numbered among His people, namely through Christ. The good news is that though we have, by our sin, excluded ourselves from participating in the family, Christ has made a way. Just as it says that Phinehas made atonement for the people of Israel and thus stopped the judgment of God on the people, so Christ has made atonement and taken upon Himself the judgment of God. The good news is that though Phinehas made atonement in this incident, Christ's atonement is not bound up for a single incident. He was sacrificed in our place, buried, rose from the grave, and is now ascended at the right hand of the Father. While Phinehas received the blessing of the earthly priesthood, priesthood of Jesus is eternal. He stands ready to apply the sacrifice to all who come to Him, and He is constantly mediating the new covenant in His blood, reconciling sinners to a holy God. So participation in the people is not based on tradition or family name, but on faith. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised Him from the dead, you will be saved. Now on to our final section, an external enemy. The name of the slain man of Israel who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, chief of a father's house belonging to the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, who was the tribal head of a father's house in Midian. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Harass the Midianites and strike them down, for they have harassed you with their wiles, with which they beguiled you in the matter of Peor and in the matter of Cozbi, the daughter of the chief of Midian, their sister, who was killed on that day in the plague on the account of Peor." So in the first section, we saw an immoral Israel. People who were part of the covenant community departed and yoked themselves to another god. They were punished for this transgression. In the second section, we saw a righteous representative in Phinehas who made atonement for the people by his just acts on the anonymous couple who attempted to infiltrate Israel's camp. Now, in this third section, we will see how the Lord deals with the other side of the equation, an external enemy. Now, a detail that has not been shared in the narrative to this point is what instigated the relationship between Israel and the daughters of Moab. It may be that the narrator wants to drive home that the bulk of the responsibility for the actions of the people of God lay with themselves. Though they may be tempted, that is no excuse for their wandering from Yahweh. Thus, we see that the first detail of punishment of the individuals of Israel who took part in the false worship of Baal. The missing link, as Pastor Kyle mentioned last week, comes to us in Numbers 31, where Balaam is finally killed in a battle. And Moses indicates in verse 16 that it was on Balaam's advice that the women caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor. Furthermore, the record of Balaam's death comes amidst the follow-through to the very command we see to Moses in this passage. It's in the context of a battle against Midian that Balaam is killed. Now, the last section here of Numbers 25 details the pronouncement of a punishment on this external enemy. We first get the names of the previously anonymous couple, Zimri, the son of Salu, and Cosby, the daughter of Zur. Both were either children of chiefs or chiefs among the people. And while Zimri is a Simeonite, and there may be a connection between his actions in particular and the dramatic decrease in the population of this Simeonite clan in the next census, the present text focuses on the heritage of Cosby, who is identified as a Midianite. The Lord speaks to Moses and instructs him to harass the Midianites for their participation in the events that transpired in our first section. And really what I think we can see in this is that not only is God concerned with the responsibility of Israel in their transgression, but he also holds to account those who tempt God's people. But the element of this passage which struck me the most is the effect that the ordering of the narrative has. And I think the order can encourage us as we seek to live lives of obedience to the Lord. So in section one, we saw an emphasis on the responsibility of those who are inside the covenant people, who bear the burden of giving in to the temptation. They are responsible for this action. However, on this section, we see that those who tempt God's people are held to account. And this can give us the confidence that God is, in fact, concerned with holding those external threats to account. But in between both of these punishments, we see this righteous representative who stands ready to do what's right. It's as if to say that though there may be threats from inside and threats from outside, there is blessing for those who stand ready to live lives of righteous obedience to Yahweh in the midst of these circumstances. Brothers and sisters, we can find our place in the midst of great difficulty by allying ourselves with Christ through faith. He is the truly righteous one who enables us to stand firm amid crazy surroundings. And we do this by the Spirit that we now have as a deposit of what's to come. So the first generation fails at the goal line. They demonstrated over and over again their hard-heartedness, their inability to humble themselves and to remain devoted wholly to Yahweh prevented their entry. Though this was a wicked generation, we can still see a glimmer of hope, right? We could still look upon this sad chapter in the history of God's people and see that all is not lost. There is still hope. In this instance, it comes through the righteous behavior of Phinehas, the one who took on the mind of God and delivered the people from the plague. So now we, those who are in Christ, can look to our present circumstances and have hope. Hope that God is still working to preserve for himself a remnant. May we now cling to Christ all the more in our present time of difficulty. May we cling to Christ when we face the desires to stray. May we cling to Christ when it feels like the enemy is tempting us to despair. He can bear the weight of your burdens. Cast your cares upon him. Pray with me.